test. Opnames, discussie, general idea, Rijksacademie, 2 november.
Talking back to the media, and more specifically talking back, when we started in 68, a long time ago now it feels, everything we did was completely bound up with the media and ideas about the media for rather simple reasons. In the late 60s, in Toronto, where we started, where we met, there was really no art scene, no art media, no art audience. What we had to do as artists from the beginning was to try and construct something which could become, or which could be perceived as, an art audience, an art scene, an art medium. When we first began, well, I'm going to backtrack a bit even earlier to constructing any sort of media events. We really began quite by accident. We moved into a house together with mutual friends. And this was a house that had been made into a storefront at some point and then made back into a house. Well, we were rather bored, and we had this storefront, so we would raid the garbage of the local stores and construct fake stores in our own storefront. Some of them quite realistic, others quite fantastic. So in a way, right from the beginning, we were constructing a sort of media response in our own living environment. There was a nurse's residence next door. We discovered a whole pile of nurse novels in the garbage one day, and we opened a nurse novel store, for example. One of the situations we found ourselves in Canada was had to do specifically with the Canadian media and its relationship to the American media. Canada is largely populated within 100 miles of the American border. So we receive all the American television, radio, newspapers, magazines, etc., etc., etc. And because of the vast resources which the American media has, the Canadian media doesn't really have much of a chance. So Canadians in general are grow up, and particularly in the 50s and 60s, we grew up perceiving reality through the eyes of another nation. On the news, we would hear about events in the United States as if they were in our own country when they were not. The other aspect of Canada is that it is a very large country with a rather small population, which means that the media that is within Canada becomes extremely important just for communication reasons, to hold the country together. When we started in 68, there was one art magazine called Arts Canada, which was quite pitiful, and not much else. Our first performance, large-scale performance, was called the 1970 Miss General Idea Pageant. It was performed for video cameras and became a sort of event in which video, the presence of the video cameras suggested that we were in a television studio. The reason we chose to do a pageant, a beauty pageant, a beauty contest, was that, first of all, it was a form which people already knew in North America. It was a cultural form which anybody could know what it was. If we did an art event, people wouldn't know what it was. But if we did a beauty pageant, they could say, well, that's a beauty pageant. Then we could put anything we wanted into the beauty pageant, and people would still think in some sort of way that they knew what it was. They didn't. The 1970 pageant grew into a whole series of performance events which took this sort of media form of events happening for the television cameras as a video studio, a television studio performance. In 1972, we started our own art magazine called File Magazine. This is it here. Since there was no media in Canada, no way for Canadian artists to perceive themselves even as being an art scene, we decided that what we needed was a magazine, and specifically a magazine which represented artists as coming from a scene. That may seem a bit obscure over here because the art scenes have, you know, centuries of tradition, but in North America, and particularly in Canada, it was quite recent. The first issues of Life were published in the format of Life magazine. We chose Life magazine because it was something that people could recognize. They wouldn't say, what was this? They would say, oh, picture magazine.
Also, Life had established the tradition of making the news. Instead of reporting on world events, a lot of Life magazine in the 50s, post-war Life, consisted on creating news, like going to a wedding in a farmhouse in Iowa and making that into a bit of news of Americana, or creating grassroots events that gave you the whole image of the whole of America, of the U.S. as a scene, basically.
So that's what we wanted to do, too. We wanted to make news, we wanted to construct news as opposed to reporting it. So there's the media that we're involved in. There is the television, the magazines. In 70, what shall I lead to next? A folder to your testing?
Sure. Well, also part of the media was the performances themselves as well as the public spectacles.
Yeah, and the other thing about the performances was that they involved a lot of artists across Canada. We constructed the performances in such a way that artists from across Canada participated as contestants in these contests. So it became another sort of communication form and a way of stringing together events and people from across the country. So that basically is the roots of how we started our involvement with the media. And we used the patterns of the mass media and the forms of the mass media basically out of necessity to construct an art scene.
Also that the strategies from advertising mass media seemed so much more effective in North America at least than any other strategy at creating a scene or creating a consumer scene, that they seem like the obvious strategies to use if one wanted to do that.
Now, I think because our relationship to media is so bound up with the work itself, what we would like to do really is just to show slides of the work and to show a short tape. And then at the end is drinks, I think, and we'll show Test Tube, which was made here in Holland in 79. During the drinks, since it's about drinking.
Sorry.
So, yeah, we should have the lights off so we can see the slides.
Can we talk about the pavilion?
Or can we see the slides?
Yeah.
It's still a bit daylight.
There's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah. In the process of having these beauty pageants, in 1971, we decided that we wanted to work towards our sort of ultimate beauty pageant, which would take place in 1984. And to house that performance, we wanted to build the 1984 Miss General Idea Pavilion. Now, the pavilion is a sort of mythical building, which has no particular location. It exists as a series of gallery installations or whatever. It can exist as, physically it can exist on videotape, and the accumulated manifestations of the pavilion are the pavilion itself.
Part of working out the theory of the pavilion is as a dialogue with architecture, sort of talking back to architecture, sort of.
The other aspect of the pavilion is that the pavilion, in a way, represents, within our construct of an art world, the pavilion represents the museum. Now, we've, in the last few years, become very interested in the museum as, in fact, a medium itself. The same way that you can address the mass media, you can address the museum structure. So as we look through the slides, you'll see what that involves. We've had a show that was here in, I think you already heard, I guess, in Basel, at the Van Eyde Museum, and it's now in Canada. And as it's been going along, we've been adding pieces to it. So a lot of the slides that we're showing here are from the final location in Montreal. And what you're seeing now is the ziggurat paintings, which we first did in 68, and then an archway from the pavilion, which was just constructed this year to go with them. It's a pretty dismal viewing situation, mm-hmm. Isn't it? Except that it's the light, really. Yeah. I mean,
you have to put it over here. Too.
Yeah.
No. What can we wait a bit for the slides?
I wonder if we should maybe just change the whole order of things and show tapes first.
And then come back to the slides
because the light will have gone down. Okay. We're going to show you the tape Cornucopia then. And Cornucopia is really a tape about the pavilion we were just talking about and also about the museum situation. You can just press the on button here.
The sound has to be changed.
The amorphous world of means and functions has traditionally been structured through the architectural act of construction. But the three artists of General Idea have reintroduced destruction into the architectural process. In their long-term project, the 1984 General Idea Pavilion, ruins are created as quickly as rooms are built. Accumulated layers of function and meaning slip in and out of focus, creating a shifting constellation of images, which is the pavilion itself. One of the most complex groupings of imagery and artifacts is the room of the unknown function. Does this room perversely have no function at all, or is that function too mysterious to penetrate? The object you are about to see were originally from this museum-like room. In these objects, the dense web of iconography, which is the pavilion, is unveiled. Imagine these shards as nodes of thought, imaged points of intersection, erected in the network of motifs and themes from which the pavilion is constructed and its fragments dispersed.
What is the purpose of this veiled image which appears not only in wall fragments and drawings, but also as actual objects collected in the room we call the room of the unknown function? These ceramic objects extract meanings from images and spit out the empty shells, like these skulls waiting to be fleshed out by the act of recognition. The cornucopia thus initiates each image into the configuration which is the pavilion itself. The ziggurat spirals are used as an invisible grid throughout the structure. Here they surface on the wall as a codex of the construction process and the exercise of executive power. The copyright motif marks the border between public and private domains. Parading ideas. The poodle's repeated relationship to water as in these swimming poodles, seems to transmute kissing into uncharted waters. One poodle's puddle is another poodle at sea.
Thank you. pretty sure.
Yeah, we're just kind of frozen.
I think because of the lighting problems, that we should just show test tube now instead of at the end. Show the other videotape now. I think it's easier, and then we'll sort of take off where we left off after that, by which time it should be dark enough to see slides.
So we have a drinks?
Okay.
So we have the drinks now? Test it? Or later?
I don't know. No, that's too complicated.
Does it go over there?
No, it has to go right to the beginning.
It has to go right to the beginning? Okay.
Sorry, this is from fast forward or rewind? Still rewind, it'll just be another minute. Actually, test tube has so much information about the media in it, so much reaction to the media, that it could have been made especially for this festival.
Here we are sitting at the Color Bar Lounge, which is of course the cocktail bar at the 1984 Miss General Idea Tavern. We like to think of the Color Bar as a sort of a cultural laboratory where we can experiment with new cultural mixes and serve them up for our friends. Here we isolate members of the art scene as our control group to test the effectiveness of our intoxicating cocktails. My name is Jorge Zontel, and this is A.A. Bronson and Felix Park. We call ourselves General Idea.
More and more artists are turning to popular media in an effort to examine the effectiveness of their work, not only in an attempt to reach a larger audience, but also to obtain access to the immediacy of newspapers, magazines, rock and roll, and of course, television itself. We think of television as our test tube, not only to test market the Color Bar Lounge, but also to test out new formulae for making art consumable.
You know, the mass media are like a vast pharmaceutical complex developing new cultural elixirs of an unprecedented intoxication. Look at music, psychology, sociology. They've all been electronically manufactured into a consumable form. But art remains a curious and elitist drink. Despite its unique flavor and heady cultural properties, it has never been effectively exploited. Now General Idea has taken the necessary risk to isolate this potent culture and introduce the infectious mutations into the mainstream. These cocktails are the medium in which the culture is grown and transferred to the host, and everyone is a host at the Color Bar Lounge.
General Idea has been working with popular forms for over 10 years now, and we find ourselves not only experimenting with, but also inhabiting the media we isolate. As we publish File Magazine, we are aware of its function as a culture incubator. So too in this television show, we try to inject into the popular mainstream of culture these germs of art discourse.
And where can we find more information on our culture than on TV? Even the most banal TV program is loaded with subliminal and not so subliminal hints on how to make our cocktails effective. So, let's settle down and see what's on the air. Michael, more drinks, please.
Oh, hello, Lana. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I've been meaning to call you, but I've been fainting. Yes, it's gone, okay. I'm almost finished, in fact. The car is exactly what I want. But, well, I'm not sure I want to exhibit right now. Can I call you back in a few minutes? No, I won't forget. Thanks. Bye.
Famous cocktail artist. It's written on my palm.
Louise, it's not destiny that makes things these days, A.A., it's the media. TV, for instance, can impose anything it wants on the public.
Well, that's a rather fascist view of television, isn't it, Felix? I mean,
well, that's what everyone says. Television is the great dictator. No matter how many channels there are, there's still no choice. Sitcoms, board game TV, game shows, and news, they're all geared towards the consumption of repressive role models. The only thing that sort of social control needs is a captive audience, and it's got them.
Come on, Felix. That conspiracy rant is so popular, it should be on television. There's public access programs, there's community television, there's ethnic television, why, there's even artist television itself. We all know there's airtime for anyone who wants it.
And besides, if a network developed overly fascist content, it would become a hot news story for the other networks.
I'm not talking about the content of the program, it's the format. It formats us as well as the program.
So what format is this program in then?
It's the I Can't Believe It's a Format. We're using a combination of talk shows, sitcoms, news magazines, and commercials. And why? To put our content into a consumable content.
Yeah, but isn't it just television a parody, or are we still making art? Would you rather be welcomed into the cozy living rooms of a nation, or be thinking away in your antique interior?
Johnny, mom is the artist of the family. That blazing isn't going to be much use anymore. I really have to keep a closer watch on it from now on. Oh, I don't know. I just hope I'm doing the right thing. Why shouldn't I exhibit? Besides, Elena's right. I have to discipline myself. I have to buckle down and play by the rules, or at least figure out what the rules are. I have to grow up and stop acting like a kid. I have to figure out who I'm trying to please. Ileana? The public? The critics? History? Myself? Is this what I really want to do? Here we go. Painting myself into corners again. Blue, blue, blue. It's like a vacuum. It sucks everything into it, but the lines control it. Give it some limit. But maybe it's too controlled. Maybe I should lose it a little bit. I wish this day could record what I think. My voice. Thin stripes of chatter slicing through the vacuum. I think it's better to see through the lines than to be behind them. It's too limiting, too confining, too controlled, too rigid. I'd rather read between the lines than take sides. But you have to take sides, don't you? But I'd rather be transparent than opaque. Oh, Johnny.
Billy here is all boys. Billy is the right blend of ingredients. Diligence, commitment, ambition, reliability, and self-confidence. The result of a perfect marriage of convenience, education, and good breeding. When Billy leaves home, he's going to need all these qualities and more. To help give him the drive he needs, Billy relies on a familiar drink with a familial flavor. The ingredients? Nothing fancy. Something found in every home. Drink it up, Billy. Enjoy it. Everywhere, boys like Billy are being initiated into the intoxicating flavor of Nazi milk. Drinks for the whole family at the Color Bar Lounge.
Here I'm trying to revolutionize television and I can't even get a bullseye.
Look, doll, the tube is the revolution. The vanguard of television, and there is a vanguard, is willing to try just about anything, no matter how stupid or unlikely it seems at first. That's the way they open up the market. That's the way to try out new possibilities and create new needs. All it takes is a single hit to create a whole slew of phone programs, and then there's guest appearances, crossover characters, and multiplying formats. Television is a constant exploratory movement. It creates new needs and then sells whole lines of new products to satisfy them. And that goes for TV, or for sex, or art, or anything.
Anything? What about artist TV? If artists had more time on television, hey, give me those darts, it's my turn.
Yeah, so many artists are disappointed when their work doesn't get on television. They just don't realize that television isn't just a neutral medium. Television is a sensibility, a vision, a pattern of thinking. And if we can act like television, think like television, be like television, we can revolutionize the artist himself.
Hey, Rob, look at that score. There's your revolution, Jorge. Three bullseyes.
If this was really revolutionary, we'd be playing a video game, not darts.
Video cocktail.
What?
Video cocktail. That's the next drink we have to invent.
Oh, you mean the revolutionary cocktail. The revolutionary cocktail makes a Molotov cocktail taste like gasoline. To the gasoline shortage.
Look, I'm sorry, Raymond, okay? My head's spinning. I just wish you wouldn't turn on me like that. Just because I don't have a one-track mind doesn't make me irresponsible. I might as well be talking to myself. Time for a change. Time to turn things around. To end of the cycle. I've just got to get off this merry-go-round. But I can't even tell what direction I'm going in. Never mind where to get off. It's always the same old go-around. Guilty social conscience. Maybe we're not right. Instead of being a cocktail party artist, I should be a revolutionary party artist. Apply my radical aesthetics to the social fabric instead of conquer. Do something more than just generate commodities and become rich, glamorous, and famous. Join the party. Sure, but let's face it. I'm not a party girl. I like parties, but it seems they all have to dance to the same regimental tune. In step, and even though I have two left feet, I always feel left out. Guilty, guilty, guilty. Everything is gilt-edged, and it just doesn't seem like a healthy starting line for me. But I guess he's right. It's time for a change.
Look around you. There are so many revolutions going on. You've revolutionized your kitchen, your shopping, your lifestyle. Now revolutionize your taste buds with revolutionary cocktails. Tame revolution's bitter nature. Fire off orders for round after round of the revolution solution of the color bar line. It's the revolution, revolution. Start your revolution at the Color Bar Lounge.
Budgets, budgets, budgets. I'm not an accountant, I'm an artist. I hate balancing budgets. We all know art assignment is supposed to seem like.
Yes, but we're not supposed to be on TV either, eh?
We are supposed to be out there, on the fringes of society, dabbling in chaos, dishing up raw new sensibilities. We're supposed to be romantic, untamed, while our artworks are slipped back into the marketplace, blue-chip investments for level-headed fetishes. That's the way capitalism always operates. It has to constantly open new markets. It cultures chaos with the understanding that there probably will be a new mutation to harvest and refine and re-inject back into the mainstream, at a healthy profit, of course.
And the problem is how to work outside the system.
No. The problem is how to work inside the system. You know why? Because there is no outside anymore. I mean, unless you're being very romantic.
How 60?
Anymore.
You mean replace the profit motive with the change motive, don't you?
Sure. Just think of capitalism as another found format that we can occupy and fill with our content.
Who's paying for this round anyway?
Oh no, really. The event at the Marinda Bag is an apex of contemporary culture. Eddie declaring is a very nice singer. Really, you can't imagine. A disco in the swimming pool. Everyone wet and dancing in the water. This was the art form of the 80s. Have you heard that song, Let's Go to the Bend?
That surely you can't ignore it. Philippe Glass has seen a child's performance. I am inviting them to perform it this year at the Venice Biennale.
Well, really, it was very nice and quite contemporary. But I think it's a little classical for us. Don't you, Marianne? Now, your paintings are a whole new thing. Look at the colour. I just bought this one. Such blue, you can't imagine. I call this your blue period, Marianne.
How can you compare this one with Philippe Glass on the other hand? Not only the structural implications, but if you knew anything about primitive music, certainly I'm not claiming your work is primitive, Marianne, but as painting about painting, you break all the rules. In fact, it's a very
Oh!
You know, Maria, I really do think you should agree to being it. I don't know why you're holding back. It could be very important for your career. You know, until the last show I didn't really like your work, but I've looked at that series again and again, and they always were.
Everything is suddenly happening again, don't you think? The 70s were so dull, but the 80s are shaking everything up. Really, you can't imagine the Marinda Bag. It was like a portent of the future. This black summer on top of a pyramid of naked boys dancing, the wave machine, the water splashing in the spotlights like diamonds. It has to be so much more.
Go on, promise blind. At the Colorbar Lounge, we like to be exploited. We don't make money on this one, because every cocktail is made of liquid assets. You don't have to disguise your thirst for solvency, because we've put our money where your mouth is. Go ahead, it tastes so good, it's almost a crime. It's our way of increasing your interest in a competitive market, and it all adds up to a capital idea. Liquid assets from the Color Bar Lounge.
Well, Nancy Melf on the cover of file seems to be really bringing it in. The TV ad must have helped too. Looks like just the right people, just as we projected.
The doorman's getting pretty confused though. There's so many new faces, he doesn't know who to let in and who to keep out. You know, we're going to have to give him another briefing on the correct mix.
Two fun-furs, a handful of new wave, one experiment as well.
Please. What we're looking for is people who are dedicated to change. People at home in transit.
Oh, you must mean the jet set.
Oh, no. He means the boat people.
No. I mean the people who patrol the borders of our culture. They have an eye out for anything that's new. Not only for novelty's sake, but because they're the reconnaissance troops of a contemporary culture. They acquire new tastes like Ouija board spell out words.
Sounds pretty trendy to me.
Well, if you mean spelling out trend, you are right. There is a role for trendies. If they could only be made conscious of it, they could harness their collective energy and make it responsible.
Or responsible to what?
Responsible to what they do best, which is spilling contents without breaking the glass, and locking doors without giving away the keys. In other words, occupying a context, emptying it of meaning, and then filling it up again with new sensibilities, rarefied sexualities, battle stances disguised as dance steps, codified cocktails. In these days of reality shortage, trendies know that any context can house multiple meanings.
Well said, Jorge. The perfect customer, sensitive palates, perfect for testing new cultural messages.
Once they recognize the new sensibility sensation, they'll get infected with enthusiasm and carry it back into the mainstream.
As I said, everybody's a host at the Color Bar Lounge.
A host to the host!
Well, I think I've discovered the best solution. No, I guess the green one is still my favorite. They all taste so good, it seems pointless to rate them. I do like the cigarette rolls. It contains such diverse tastes, so transparently. As intoxicating as they are, they still maintain a certain clinical sobriety. I could have slowed down. They go into my head. I should have worn a lab coat, but at least I will wear it. I didn't know the color bar was also a gray bar. Oh, I guess I'm just fashion subconscious. I soak up new attitudes like a fog. I feel so in sync. I must be a closet trainer. This trainer was a breath of fresh air and a relief from hot air. Even if it spans from fast, it doesn't have much motion. This weapon would be revolting on itself. But despite its bitter aftertaste, it's supposed to be good for the system. Well, this one's definitely a breakthrough. No more confusion over whether it's a bottle in front of me or a frontal lobotomy. What an intoxicating idea. People creating their own solution. A cocktail lab dedicated to eradicating abstract depressionism.
Have you got a drinking problem? Do you feel confused when faced with today's bewildering choice of drinking possibilities? Do you find it difficult to make up your mind? Does Never Mix, Never Worry prevent you from enjoying the full spectrum of drinking combinations? Have you got a drinking problem? Do you resent the traditional dogma of wine and wine glasses, brandy and snifters? Do you long to mix aesthetics, dodge expectations, be creative? Would you like to vary your contents without being labeled neurotic or schizo? If you have a drinking problem, General Idea has the answer. At the Color Bar, we call it the solution. With this handy tray and glasses, you can mix multiple drinks and never worry about incompatible rhetorics. Tired of those same old contents? With these magnetic cups, you can spill the contents without breaking the context and fill them up again. Remember, it's the solution. Decision-making is obsolete at the Color Bar Lounge.
Hello? Ian?
Just to feature the voices of Lyle Mayers, Daniel Groom, Robert Hanford, Marianne Van Kersen, Marshall Lord, Titus Musilak. Dutch translation by Lauren Bayers. A special thanks to Annelies Wolf, Johan Crimson, Tom Finkelstein, Stange, Paderu, Ina Rica. Wells Fargo Saloon, Holland's Glory Cafe, Augie Knapes, Doreen Mignol, Stidlet Museum, Salty Dog, Daniel Broom, Video Heads, Beast Smalls, Yosin Van Droppelaar, and Robert Hansworth. My name is Bernard Gazelle. Good night.
Through the crowd with the catalog now?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to announce?
Yeah, I will.
So I hope you're enjoying the Color Bar.
Before we show you the slides, I think it's dark enough now to see the slides. We're going to pass out the program to the slides. I don't think we have enough for everyone, but almost. This is a
sort of media piece that we did unintentionally. When our show was at the Van Abbey Museum, was exhibited in Toronto, a fashion company approached us to see if they could shoot fashion photos for their catalog in our installation. And we said yes. So they published this catalog, which is all photographs of awful fashions in the Miss General Idea Pavilion. At the end of the slides, you'll see the latest piece which we're working on right now, which is our response to this catalog.
It just shows that you don't have to dress well to get into the pavilion. They were like generic contestants, like there could be anybody.
This is a close-up of a piece called Luxon BB. It's a Venetian blind with double-sided mirror, which will be on all the windows in the pavilion. What that does, it's impossible to photograph properly, but what it does is it collages together images of the outside and the inside. Unfortunately, because of the differences in daylight and artificial light, you can't photograph that effect. This is how it was installed on the Van Abbey. This is the room where the contestants wait for they get to go on stage for the pageant. And this room was one of the rooms that was rescued from the ruins of the pavilion after it burned down, and the actual images of the fire are built into the photographic wall panels on each side. For those of you who saw Cornucopia, I guess gathered that at some point the pavilion burnt down. As 1984 grew closer, and we realized we might have to actually build the pavilion, we got more and more nervous, but the pavilion burned down and solved all of that. And now we spend all our time looking through the remnants. This was the hoarding, just a sample of it, which was going to be erected around the site when we were building it. This was a sort of three-dimensional sketch for the color bar, showing the various drinks and with menus closely related to the videotape. This is the boutique from the pavilion. Every pavilion needs its boutique. Every museum needs its boutique. It's in the shape of a dollar sign. And in this boutique, we sell our multiples, which play the part of consumer objects. I guess the whole piece is about consumerism.
It was also a way just to bring together all the sort of miscellaneous pieces that we've done over the years, the sort of small multiples and publications and postcards and things like that, which we sort of continually producing.
This is Liquid Assets. It's one of the cocktail holders from the color bar, an it's on sale in the boutique. This is the Nancy Milk cocktail from the Kellogg. This was the very first issue of Files in 1972. You can see the lifelike format. Life sued us for that. This was the French issue, the Eiffel issue. And this is the new format after we had to change our design. But this is actually our 10th anniversary issue, that's our birthday cake. This was a piece we did, when?
January.
January this year, yeah, in Middleburg, at the Place Hall. And it's the, it, I guess, represents most clearly the ruins of the pavilion. Well, it's actually the ruins of the Chroma Key Club. Now, the Chroma Key Club is the sort of, it's the club in the pavilion.
It's still on the drawing boards, or still hasn't been unearthed, one of the two. We haven't really developed one.
This is in the exhibition in Montreal now. It's in Montreal right now. This is the entrance to the archaeological display of fragments from the pavilion. And these are all pieces that were unearthed. Am I blocking your view there? These are all pieces that we managed to unearth from the ruins of the pavilion. Some of them are in quite bad shape. This piece is called Three Graces. It seems to represent the artists themselves. This piece is from the Room of the Unknown Function. We call it the Room of the Unknown Function because every room at the pavilion had a function, but we don't know quite what the function of this room was. Which makes it rather similar to a museum, don't I think. The Building of the Unknown Function. A close-up. Fragment of wall painting rescued from the ruins. I think this was from the boudoir. This general idea's boudoir. This is a massive wall of tiles. With this fresco inset of the Phoenix Poodles. Putting out the fire by peeing. On the left is the cornucopia installation, which is a sort of museum-like installation housing all the objects which you saw in the cornucopia tape.
It also has the tape. The television set is sort of mounted, dropped into the floor.
This is the stable where we keep the poodles and where we milk them. I guess these are sort of distilling devices for turning the milk into champagne or something.
Called Pias for poodles.
This piece is called XXX Blue. It was actually a performance at the Centre d'Art Contemporain in Geneva. We used the poodles as paintbrushes and painted three giant X's. Now, this piece is actually the basis for the videotape which we've made, especially for talking back to the media. And I wish we could show it to you, but it'll be premiered later in the month. And here you can see how the poodles were used as paintbrushes.
The whole piece was sort of loosely structured around the Eve Klein paintings, of course, and East Klein's representation in the film Mondo Cane, and the Mondo Cane reference to our poodles and etc. etc. There was a string quartet playing the soundtrack from Mondo Cane while we did the performance paintings.
I think one of the interesting things about the media is the way that the only way it can really represent an artist, this is especially true in North America, is as a sort of crazy lunatic bohemian. And Eve Klein, of course, represented that so completely. The media just...
For the media.
For the media, yeah. And the tape that we've done for Talking Back to the Media is on that theme. The artist is the crazy lunatic. More objects unearthed from the rooms. This is the entrance to the Mondo Cane and Kama Sutra room.
It looks like an airport. It would look good in a big airport.
Yeah.
Close up.
Oops. This is a little, you can see on the front of the Van Adden Museum, there's a little crest. We redesigned the crest of Eindhoven a little bit to fit in better with our exhibition. And this is a flag we designed for the city of Kent. They were actually silkscreened and put up around the city, but they caused quite a scandal because the Flemish nationalists were very insulted that their lions had been turned into poodles. I mean, the flag is exactly like that, but with a lion. And so there was a big controversy in the city council and newspaper articles every day and big fights, and finally they put them all down. At that point, different private individuals and the newspapers and the television stations and so on all came forward and offered to put up the flags on their flagpoles, so all the flags went back up again. Here you can see it a little better. This is the piece that we're working on right now, based on this catalog. This is just showing the cover of the catalog and then the altered cover of the catalog.
Now called Lip, which we sort of think is a form of talking back to the media.
Yeah, of course, the blue color that we're using is really chroma key blue. And I don't know how to quite explain that, but it's the blue that you use in television technology when you want to replace one image with another. So if we use this in a video piece, we could replace the blue figures with anything we wanted, any other pre-recorded material. It's also international fine blue. Essentially, we're erasing the media involvement here. Idea was that at this point there could be some
some sort of exchange, yeah.
I think we could start with gratitude questions. I'm sure there are people here that are responsible. Would you come up front when you're in the portal? Just try to get the discussion also. What I'd like to start to ask you is, did criticizing the system inside the art world, did it help or did it make it more difficult to get your art into the museum? I know that with somebody like Hans Hagen, who always criticized the system, it was most of the time very difficult to do that at the same time and have to work in a show, which is also a paradox. Could you comment on that?
Well, our work is always ambiguous. It's never clear whether we're criticizing or not. But yes, it's made it much more difficult. And I think it's not the criticism that's made it more difficult, but it's the ambiguity. The fact that people are never, often not quite sure what the work is saying, if it is critical of the system or if it's participating in it. They're afraid that they're being
made fun of,
yeah.
I don't think critical work has that much trouble getting to the museum. It's getting into the commercial art world that critical work has trouble. I think most museums pay attention to critical work in general.
Yeah, but it's collectors don't want it.
So you sell mainly your tapes or the objects
well,
that are
part of the installation? Huh? To institutions, I mean to museums or whatever. And also tends to be the truth of our work in general, that it sells better to a museum than to a collector. For collectors, they're really too nervous of it.
But do you think that has to do with the content of the work, or with the fact that it's an installation? I think that most collectors or people who make a collection are used to an object.
We have lots of thinkers.
Oh, yeah. Frankly, we don't know what the problem is. But we're working hard on it. No, it's funny. I really don't know what to think. I mean, there's several things that you can think about it. One is by being a group, and a group of three, not like a group of two. It seems to be, it's obviously not unusual. It's unorthodox, and I think maybe that has something to do with it. People don't know quite what to make of the work of three people. It doesn't fit into any sort of historical category, and therefore we become sort of like freaks in a sense. We never fit into any of the sort of movements or whatever that I mean in the commercial world seem to be so important to creating that sort of sales interest.
Did you ever discuss that problem with Art and Image?
No, but I'm sure that they have similar problems in a sense.
Swinger,
I mean, as far as selling goes.
I've discussed it with Lord Swinger. I mean, it's a very similar thing, that, you know, there's a lot of interest in the part of galleries and museums, and the collectors are all extremely nervous.
No, I thought the part of working the three of you, like Art and Language not anymore being three, but just two.
Uh-huh, right.
And I think a lot of people would like to be interested in how that works. I mean, we've been working together since 68, and for example, writing, is one of you more or less the writer or not? I mean, the lines and the text and the whole reference to language is so important.
No, they're done, the writing is mainly very collaborative. Like somebody has an idea, sort of a bunch of phrases that will be strung together, and then we will get together and rewrite and expand, throw it out, start over, what have you. But it's usually sort of a group work, you know, like sitting around a table and working it out.
I think our work differs from a lot of work in that it's additive, that we're constantly adding things. And the process of writing is essentially additive. That somebody has an idea and they give it to someone else and they rewrite it, and then somebody else writes it again, and somebody else takes it and cuts it up and puts it back in another order.
And somebody gets angry. And
so often it's based on things like our style or a style that we've chosen to work in, so that becomes common. And so much of it is sort of self-referential or additive.
A lot of them.
So it's using old images that we've used before, or cliches, sort of.
But I think for most artists, they're usually involved in the opposite process of trying to pare things down, or trying to unload information, trying to...
You mean getting rid of the cliches?
Well, not only getting rid of the cliches, but of subtracting. Of trying to...
Well, taking more or less?
Taking away the unessentials. But for us, it's adding more and more essentials.
I think the whole, I don't know, people should stop me when they want other pictures in the enter the cells, but if not, I just can say, this whole issue of appropriation and quoting is now very much in fashion. Is that a reason for you to ironize that too? I mean, you've been appropriating life by making file, and a lot of other themes have been appropriating Eve Klein by using the blue of Klein and mixing it together with the blue of the television. You said it, the chromatic blue. You've done it such a long time. Now this seems to be a sort of a fashion.
Well, Sherry Levine had an interesting comment on that. She said there's so many younger artists doing appropriation now that she had to find some way of solving that, so she's doing generic art now. She's working on stripe paintings, which aren't copying anyone in particular, but they look like they've copied someone in particular. Interesting paintings.
I don't understand quite the difference.
Then. Between generic and appropriation? Well, inappropriate, I mean, well, specifically for Sherry Levine, if you see the Turner works in the exhibit at Oregon, for example, she's actually taking other artists' images and using them as her images, whether she just photographs them or whether she repaints them as close as she can or whatever. But now what she's doing is producing an image which looks as if it's being stolen from someone, only you don't know who. And in fact, it doesn't exist.
But it's just like the same thing, only turned on.
Yeah,
that's like formats. Appropriating
formats. Well, we're genre. Yeah, actually, this is metaphorically a similarity there.
Yeah, I think ours are more generic usually. I mean, as opposed to a specific thing. I mean, we don't copy something exactly.
Is the take that you made talking about the media an exception?
Yeah, we've broken all the copyright laws, I think, in that case. We've used specific images from existing films and from television.
And that's an unusual thing for you to do?
Well, at one time we used to use a lot of found images in the magazine, and in our work we used to use found images from magazines, but we haven't done that for a long time, and I don't think we've ever used found footage from television before. It's the first time.
We have used magazine imagery before, but... No.
If you can whet our appetites slightly, is the take that you've made generic in the sense that Test Tube was generic, or that Cornucopia had sort of flavors of certain documentaries? Is it a bound format, or are you stepping into another realm?
No, I think it looks more just like generic TV,
yeah.
I think. It's like all of them in a sense, but it's just... sort of using television conventions and editing and pacing and words and music, that type of thing, talking heads, that type of... It's actually pretty straightforward, really.
Was Cornucopia the last video tape you made for this one?
Right.
No, Loco.
Oh,
There's another short tape called Loco, which was made in between.
And that was made in Canada?
That was made in Canada. That was also made for television. I feel like I should ask questions.
So,
actually that I do want to ask, I've been meaning to ask, is that in the title Talking Back to the Media, what is the meaning of talking back? Because, I mean, for me in English, it has a colloquial meaning which means to negate or to disagree with, and I'm wondering if that's, is that what it means in this case?
Is that Sebastian?
No, it's me.
Is it David?
Yeah. It was just in the sense of, but I think it's the American usage that I picked up from watching American TV, and I don't know how accurate that was, which is a child,
talking back to its mother.
Which was why I was rather glad to see Baldassare's, Pink Baldassare's poster, which in a way rather captures that, which is the small finger pointing up at the big finger. I mean, we had no connection with Baldassare, I mean, we just took it in that way, which is the small kind of the subcontext, you know, talking up to the large one and perhaps enabling you to see it in a fresh way. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like don't talk back kind of reaction that fathers or mothers have to children in America, which meets the opposite problems, you know, talking back.
We took it that rather than a small child, we took it more adolescent. Because the tape is called Shut the Fuck Up. The new tape is that there it's not only the Eve Klein, but it's also other elements from real television, which is shockingly similar to the Eve Klein, the way Eve Klein was presented in Mondo Klein. And that is what the popular audience thinks. They don't think of Yves Klein, they don't know of Yves Klein, but they know the representation of the artist.
They're very familiar with they might not know his name. They might not know specifically that he did this piece with the models and the blue paint.
Become the sort of television film cliche of the artist, you know, sort of, when you can see it, it's sort of the studio set with this, you know, sort of comedy sort of routine of throwing the paint and the monkey throwing tomatoes at the canvas. It's, it really got around.
Yeah, it's an image of the artist which completely dominates Hollywood film. And I suppose that, I mean, I can only suppose that it's Yves Klein who provided the original model in a way, you know, in terms of the 60s and 70s movies.
Well, Tanguy too did some his share.
We stop there?
I don't know, I was just thinking about actions taking that actions take a lot of publicity and as soon as you do an action, it could be also a way to get attention for the work. And in the end, what you'd like to see is also a work. I don't know if in your personal history, doing performances and actions and things outside or fashion shows were also considered as a sort of an internal way of publicity, of something you knew very well, that putting it in the streets and putting it out would get more attention for the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think actually one of our main interests in the sort of more popular forms like beauty pageants and television and was because, as A.A. was saying, that when we started working, there was no sense of an audience. There was nobody out there that was interested in what you were doing. So in a sense, we had to go and find available audiences, an audience, and then sort of assemble and our audience out of that. So it was what was going in that direction.
Right. And that's what we did. We stole basically little audiences, a bit of a rock and roll audience and an architectural audience and a design audience and a theater audience, and we put them all together and made an art audience out of it in the Canadian context.
Can I ask one thing? Do you think of yourself as part of the Canadian tradition at all? Because I mean, I think of that magazine that was done by Martin McClure and the other people. I can't think of his name offhand, but it was based on an English magazine, or he said so, by Lyndon Lewis. This sort of thing, psychoanalyzing the media, seems to have a long tradition. And I wonder whether you, I mean, a lot of people just seem to react as though you're kind of a bolt from the blue or something, but I've always had the feeling that you're part actually of a Canadian tradition and a Canadian way of looking at things, you know, perhaps a bit more public than a lot of people, but nevertheless part of the street. Would you agree with that or not?
Yeah, I would actually. I mean, just in terms of the present, you can find a whole stream of art activity in Canada that's closely related to us and related to ideas about the medium, about communications.
Yes, but actually, that could be seen as having been inspired by you, but what I want to know is whether there were antecedents.
Well, that's what I was trying to say in the beginning about the both the relationship to the United States and the vast size of the country. Both made the relationship to the media extremely important just to one's self-image as a nation. And you find now, for example, that in the entertainment industry in the States, there's a really large proportion of Canadian involvement in the American entertainment industry, and specifically in the comedy area. I don't know why, but the comedy area seems to be completely dominated by Canadians, and I think it's somehow related.
The jokes are very important in your work as well.
Yeah, actually, again, the new tape is very much about the structure of a joke. How does a joke work?
So yeah, I think Marshall McLuhan was also no accident. He's a real Canadian product. You know, his way of putting together information is very Canadian. How do we gauge when we're successful at what we're doing, or how successful we are at what we're doing?
When
successful in terms of doing what you want.
I never know. I can't tell.
It seemed like one index was not selling to collectors ever. That seemed to be an
index. We've never.
No. Much more.
No, we'd love to sell to collectors.
I think that, like, we love talking about the whole sort of art business aspect, and it tends to sound that that's really the interest. But I think it's just a fascination in a sense. It's like when we made Test Tube. There was a fascination of really getting it on TV and really getting involved in that getting your work on television. And we were sort of ambiguous about it. Yes, we wanted to be on television, but no, we didn't really want to be on television, etc. But I think we were attracted to it because of the, in a sense, the power or the audience that it would give us to be in that. And I think that we would like to participate more in what happens in the collector scene from the inside rather than sort of from the outside of it. Does that make any sense? No? Why doesn't it make sense?
Or is it just not understandable?
It's understandable, but it doesn't even make sense. The last thing is...
You mean why we... Right. Well, it seems like it's too much of a cliche. Pardon me.
As if what goes on in collector's world is a mystery or something.
No, no, no more than television is a mystery. It's not a mystery. It's more that. Well, for example, our relationships with dealers have always been have always been difficult with some and very good with others. And it's because we have so much involvement with the presentation of our work, and also with the promotion of the work, because the whole idea of promotion or publicity is actually built right into the nature of the work itself. So we can't play the part of the sort of idiot artist who can sit in his studio and churn out paintings while the dealers can, you know, create a career for him. So that's one model that we can't follow. Not saying that that's the only model there is, obviously it's not. What we're always interested in doing is incorporating the actual structure of the situation into the work. So when we show in museums, a lot of the pieces that we devise and so on are actually commentary on the museum situation or whatever. When we show in a gallery, we often tend to involve ideas about the gallery dealer situation into the work. And I think the new phase of that is coming to be, I mean, the work that we've been producing recently has something about collectors and collecting in it.
And at the moment, it's a very large component of the art scene, the whole, selling to private collectors. It's very powerful, as powerful as the museums.
But of course, that's the very thing that, I mean, the fact that Test Tube was in a way about television made television nervous. And in the same way we make some dealers nervous. And in the same way we can make collectors nervous. So in a way it always works against us. So we don't judge our success. We can't judge our success in terms of something like sales. We have to judge it in terms of we've managed to integrate all those ideas into the overall pattern of our work. Because essentially, our work is one big piece. And the success of any element has to be judged on its relationship to all the other work, I think.
Also, collectors like to buy definite equations that have been crystallized and worked into one, you know, resolved equation, independent equation. Most of our work, again, as I was saying, is part of a larger oeuvre, and it's always each individual object has tentacles into other things, into politics and collecting and art scenes and museum situations, and it's very seldom something that does be produced is a, you know, complete in itself, self-contained unit, which is what most collectors would rather have, and it's understandable.
But I don't want to give the impression by showing tapes and by talking in that way that we consider ourselves alternative, you know, that we're, I mean, I don't see us as being...
Or you shouldn't give the impression that we don't sell to collectors either.
No.
But we do. Maybe we're just disappointed we don't sell
enough. I'm just going back to your original question and then your comment. I don't think that we judge our success by being failures through somebody else's eyes. I mean, I think there is a whole stream of artists who judge their success on how well they can fail in a commercial sense. And I don't think that we fit into that category.
Well, it seems like it's a very difficult fence-sitting situation. You must get feelings that you're being co-opted quite often, like when you show on television or show on the museum or like that.
Well, in a way, but because there's so many layers built into the work, those people who want to read the work on a superficial level, and in many cases that might be a programmer in television, right? They'll put the work on the air because it's got grabby images or something, right? In a way, they're co-opting us by doing that. But at the same time, we know that the other layers of information that are in the tape are going out to this big audience, and that a certain percentage is going to pick up more than that superficial element. So it's I'm not sure that fence sitting is the right metaphor. We have built into the work something sort of akin to fence sitting. It feeds the system, you know, it feeds the system's weaknesses while at the same time building in the opposite ingredients, the opposite elements. We have been accused of participating in all the things we supposedly criticize, and in a sense, we do simultaneously participate and criticize. But it's not fence-sitting. I think we're on both sides of the fence at the same time, if you move your way.
So, what you call talking there? So, it's a different language that getting into the media?
Getting into the media?
It's a perverse dialogue, I think. It's, in a way. It's sort of like... You sort of hope that you are engaging in some sort of dialogue with the media.
But actually, you know, not in terms of the mass media, for the last 5 years, not much of our work has really been aimed at the mass media, very little of it. The test tube was really the last thing we made that really addressed that until the one we just produced now. So our work in general, I don't think, is about talking back to the media. I think the tape that we've produced is about talking back to the media, but... that's why I asked the question about how what was the meaning of talking back.
But is your work in general site-specific in the way that if you make installations from museums, you want to work on that level and want to focus on that situation?
Well, site-specific, situation-specific. It tends to be, but it's not always. It's just when we can do something that's specific to a situation, we love to do it. But I mean, all the work that we've produced over the years is still being exhibited, and no longer in its original situation. So I think the work has to be put together in such a way that it continues its own existence afterwards.
For example, the ruins, the blue ruins in Middelburg, which you made, were very beautiful in contrast to the architecture there. But it could have been anywhere else.
Well, actually, it could have been. It could have been in other places, but in fact, it's been destroyed. So, We couldn't find another. I mean, it's a very difficult piece to store, that one. It's an awful lot of volume.
It was already the shambles.
Yeah, but I mean, just to find to rent a warehouse big enough to hold it.
But it was very site specific, but in a very sort of ephemeral way. I mean, its relationship to the building, which had been destroyed in the war, and for the local audience, we're quite familiar with that. There were photographs of it after it was destroyed, which actually all happened as sort of series of coincidences that we had decided to do this piece, and then all this other history started to unfold out of it. So in a sense, it was a sort of layering of meanings as references to our own work as well as the specific situation there.
But we have found actually several other sites where we would like to do the piece, but it's not possible because we couldn't. Just because of the storage problems, the piece had to be destroyed at a certain point because there was nowhere to put it.
But when you find different places when you did find different places where you could have presented it, then is it still an installation in the sense that isn't it an object then, in a way?
No, because
a mass because it's an installation but one thing.
No, because it would look completely different. For example, one of the sites we discovered is a huge flight of stairs, where the piece would be assembled to completely fill the staircase, very elaborate staircase. So it becomes a different piece, really. We would just use the same elements and the same idea.
But it also starts to go into the pavilion part, where that obviously moves around, and that's made up of objects. But it does actually occupy the architecture. So in a sense, it is site-specific, but it's mobile, sort of expands and contracts.
Yeah, we like to think that a specific site is the pavilion. That's the real site. And all of the other sites are temporary sites. Or if you think of the pavilion as the parasite, that's the real site and the parasite. And the museums are like the hosts of the parasite.
First of all, it has a collection of videotapes and artist books and audio works, and basically artworks in multiple media format. And secondly, it distributes artists' videotapes, and thirdly, it distributes printed matter and audio works and so on, especially artist books. And it now does some publishing as well. So we started that in 1974 because there was no way, especially in Canada, of getting any information around or even of finding anything in Canada. And it just grew and took on its own life, and it's now a relatively large and stable institution with 8 or 9 people working there and so on.
Are you still intimately involved in it?
Yeah, well, we're still the board of directors, and I work there on a part-time basis.
But is it strictly practical? Do you think that it's an art movement where it's a strictly practical thing of getting the works?
For the longest time, we'd like to think of it as the archives of the pavilion. But the people working there used to get upset about it being thought of as extras in this general idea movie. So we had to pretend that... We had to let it go. Because if you wanted to get really, people that were like had their own ideas and wanted to do interesting creating stuff, you couldn't let them, you couldn't create this tight context and make them work in there. I think in the back of our minds, we still think of it as some sort of foundation for the pavilion, some sort of media center at the pavilion. spirited.
The third meaning, I mean, of spirits is alcohol and drunkenness, right? I mean, that's part of it, too.
No, but I wonder how much you would you deal with the fact that I think irony is sometimes can have a self-limiting factor, because then sometimes it's bound to the limitations of the things it's ironizing. And I just wonder if this this ambiguity is something you carefully construct, or if it's something you
fall into.
You fall into, or something that bothers you. Also.
Something that what?
Bothers us.
Bothers us.
I think we like to think that the most successful work is the one that captures ambiguity without falling into it. We used to throw in a cliche saying ambiguity without contradiction, which used to be one of those mottos. I think it's a borderline.
Well, there's two questions there. The first one is the limitations which the language sets up, right? But I think in a way it's the opposite. It's a way of escaping the limitations, because you set up these sort of networks of ideas that go beyond the original word.
I mean, take the case of the poodle. You might think that we are ironizing everything that a poodle stands for in society, or what a poodle is, but it's not really. I mean, the poodle has become a whole vocabulary of its own, and it goes in thousands of directions. And I think that happens with most cliches that we like to work with, is that we like to bounce them around with new meaning and create a meta language that goes beyond the original cliche. And the poodle is the most clear one. So.
No, I'm aware of it. It's not that simple. Yeah. It's a simple concept. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it has to happen. I don't think you can kind of set it up. I think there's.
I don't know if we see it as such a hard task to construct. It's more. I think it's basically the way. It's like cultural landscape painting, and that's sort of what we see. And so we try and construct, in a sense, our how we respond. We have these ambiguous feelings about things, and we do. You know, go to both extremes and question them, and then try and deal with that in the work. You know, package it together, keeping both sides sort of on either side of the fence, and refining it, I guess, is the difficult part, or putting it together.
Keeping it under control is difficult too.
Yeah,
it
doesn't
have to be. Well, in a way, you can just get so carried away.
But that's how we got into, in the latest tape, the idea of the joke, because our whole involvement with the Eve Klein and the Poodles and Mondo Cane and the Blue and the soundtrack for Mondo Cane More and et cetera, it became this sort of like jokes that were sort of going off in all these different directions. It was like a joke to call the Poodles Mondo Cane, sort of a little joke, and then et cetera, et cetera, and it sort of built, and it was sort of some sort of bizarre joke structure that never really had a punchline, but it and it doesn't really come together as sort of as a punchline. And I think that in a way the intention was to build sort of a in a way capture the hysteria of when we're actually working together and start talking about doing something, and it's spinning off in all these crazy directions, and it becomes quite sort of, I don't know if hysteria is the correct word, but it I don't know, it almost becomes a spiritual experience when it just becomes you're just barely able to hold on to the logic that's sort of so fragilely constructed, or something like that.
Yeah,
in it. Other people have said that about us.
Sorry?
Other people have said that about us. There was one quote where they said that we were going to end up like Dorothy Parker, in, sort of in a filthy bedroom with littered with dog droppings and empty liquor bottles, because we created this sort of, we've distanced ourselves from everything and had become sort of the social observers in a sense. We were always in an observing position, which I guess is putting
it. It's also looking to lovelessness in a way, somehow. That kind of the dangers of what, I mean, I thought that question was driving in a sense, you know, the dangers of everything in quotation marks, everything I wanted to see. Just though you're living in second hand, so you're watching everything on the television.
I don't know if you'll accept this premise, but it seems that since Warhol, artists are living in an ironic world. And if that's the case, then it seems like you're being redundant in your irony, because you, one can art cannot be anything but ironic. How do you respond to that?
I'm seeing so much I presume is non-ironic art. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think a lot of artists would not like to have that said about their work and their context, you know. Mm-hmm. I think in a way you're right in that, he's put quotation marks around everybody's work in advance of them even making it, in some sort of cultural sense. I mean, I do think that every artist at this point has to deal with Warhol.
My hypothesis that for a moment there in being, I'm saying that perhaps you're doubly redundant, that in some strange reversal you might end up being serious.
that's sort of how we think of ourselves, actually.
Sort of, like earnest?
We are in earnest, bringing the message of doom.
I think it's become obvious that we are in earnest, if nothing else, just because we're going at it for so long. I mean, you can sustain a joke for only so long. We couldn't be going at it for so long and not be at earnest at some level, I'm afraid.
And we we do get insulted when the media treat us as comedians, basically. It's the most awful thing that anyone could say about it. We do get very upset about that. So I suppose that on some level we do see ourselves as being in earnest, in fact.
Yeah, we like to be able to say ourselves that we are jokers, but the media to treat us as serious artists. That would be the ideal. And I think he's in earnest. But, after seeing, Cindy Sherman dressing up as an artist for an article of her in the Village Voice or somewhere, which had dressed up to look like an artist and posed like an artist, like an earnest artist, it's difficult to maintain that pose, in earnest.
It's interesting, there was an interview with Schnabel in the, what's the paper? The Times? In the Times. And it was not for the art
section. It wasn't an art review, it was for the lifestyle section. And the most of the article is about the fact that Schnabel was very upset that he was being presented in a lifestyle context rather than as a serious artist in the art review section. And he ends up looking very funny. And it's quotes of...
Well, they were out to get him.
They were out to get him, obviously, but there's a fairly lengthy quote of something that he had written to explain his art, which sounds completely stupid because it's so earnest, because he's so trying so hard to be serious.
Yeah, I think it's the perfect substitution for Warhol right now.
like an antitoad. Thank you.
Somebody had it.
Another catalyst?
Yeah. I think...